Hey guys, welcome to the Grumpy Dungeon Master Show. I'm Jay.
I'm Chris.
God, you are so slow on those intros, man. Oh, and we have a special guest with us today.
Hey, this is Jeff. Nice to be with you guys.
Thank you. This is a completely weird and new intro. We're not used to having a lot of guests on here, so.
Yeah, you're third, I think, right now. We had a podcaster friend of ours who was a DM that came on before, and then we had a good friend of ours who runs a LARP. So you would be our first actual official, like, published dungeon master who's actually written official content. So, you know, you're the gold standard for us.
First of many, hopefully. The first of many.
When we kick it off, Jeff, why don't you tell everybody, I guess, just a little background of who you are and what you've done, and we just go from there.
Yeah, sure. So, I've been DMing D&D for, probably 30 years now, right? And I started writing content, I guess it was maybe 9 years ago. Back during fourth edition, I started by writing some adventures in Dungeon Magazine, and then ended up working on some of the flagship adventure products as the game was transitioning into fifth edition. So I co-authored Legacy of the Crystal Shard, which was actually back when it was called D&D Next, right? So 5th edition hadn't rolled out yet, and we were kind of working with an interim rules system, which was fun. And then I also worked on Princes of the Apocalypse. I've also done some work with Toonhound Studios for their Table Titans line. So I wrote their first adventure, which was The Terror of Haverford, based on their first season of the comic. Then I kind of took a little break from D&D writing for a few years, but now I'm back at it, and happy to be here. Now that I've come back, the Dungeon Masters Guild is a thing. That wasn't even a thing when I left. Now it's a big thing. So that's pretty cool, pretty exciting. The community has really, really grown hugely over these past several years. So it's an exciting time to be back.
Yeah, we talk about the D&D community growth. It sounds like you're sort of in the same age range that me and him are. Like, I'm mid-40s at this point. So I grew up, I started playing in 1990, rural Georgia. So I kind of grew up, in that era, in those locations where it was considered not okay to play D&D and so forth. It has just massively, massively grown over this past decade. Part of that, I think, is because of Critical Role. Part of it is because of 5th edition. Hopefully nobody hates you for starting in 4th edition, but it's not your fault. You have no control over the editions. You're just a writer, so.
Well, I secretly love 4th edition, but I love all the editions.
I started in 4th edition when I heard Chris Perkins take the Penny Arcade guys and Scott Kurtz through, I guess they were doing the beta stuff at that time for 4th edition, and mm-hmm. I was immediately hooked, and I had never really tried D&D until 4th edition, so my first and only exposure to Dungeons & Dragons was 4th edition for quite a long while, and I kind of play 5th now. I'm like, this is just 4th edition with some improvements, and I get so much heat for that. It's weird.
I feel that 4th edition, as it was written, works beautifully for the board games. I own several of the board games that were released. There's just 4th edition rules. It works great. You have cards for your actions and so forth. fifth edition is mostly fourth edition, but like you said, with just a few upgrades.
Yeah, I feel like that must have been, that must be interesting having come to the game in fourth edition, since it was, you know, it definitely was a very different presentation of the game than the other editions, right? And you know, I think you're right where fifth edition has a lot of the design work under the hood still carries forward a lot of what they did in fourth, but obviously, you know, it's presented much more, you know, the way that previous editions had been.
Yeah,
more traditionally. Yeah,
yeah. You're not playing cards to do things,
right? Right, exactly. Yeah, you know, and it's funny. It's like, yeah, fourth edition actually. I remember getting started on that edition through the D&D miniatures game that they had launched, and I think they you know relaunched that with their second edition that was updated with a basically a stripped down version of the fourth edition rule set. You know, just a couple months before the fourth edition core books came out, and that was actually how my wife got into the game, was through the miniatures game, and she loved that because she's all about the combats, right? So it was all combat all the time, so that suited her just fine.
Person from my own heart.
then I tried to, you know, pull her in on my tabletop game, and you know, we would get to the story bits, and she'd just be like, "This is boring." I'm checking out. You guys let me know when it's time to roll dice.
Sounds like your wife there. She's on character number 5 of the, you know,
yeah,
campaign.
I almost have the opposite problem where my wife wants more of the role playing content and the, you know, interesting story elements to kind of happen. I'm like, yeah, but the combat. You want to do the combat. She's like, I'll do the combat, but I want to have intricate stories and stuff. So it's kind of weird.
She keeps getting intricate backgrounds that end up leading to her intricate death.
In our, we've been playing Rime of the Frostmaiden on our Twitch stream, and like I said, she's on her third character because the first one was killed by a Grell. The second one turned on the party because they were going straight evil and aligning themselves with the Frostmaiden. Her next one, I was like, you know what, you're an intellect devourer inside of this character, and you're trying to figure out just your way in life and trying to find your mind flayer. Well, they just so happen to find a mind flayer, and now she's basically retiring that character and starting another one. So she's burning through characters quite a lot nowadays, but she's created a whole new one with this intricate backstory, and she's made a little model and everything, and she's just looking forward to doing it, and it's going to be very interesting. So you said you started D&D as a whole like around fourth edition, or were you playing like third and stuff
before? Oh no, I played
if he's been going for 30 years, you're either a red box or second edition guy.
Yeah, so I came into it when second edition hit the market.
Yep.
But it was funny because I didn't start with second edition. I started with first edition. I only remember that second edition was a thing because I remember seeing another kid in my class, you know, pull out his second edition player's handbook in homeroom. I didn't even know what it was, right? And he said, "Oh yeah, it's, you know, this game, you know, me and my friends play. It's cool, you know." And so that was what kind of piqued my interest, but I didn't end up playing with him, at least not initially. I didn't have anybody to, you know, kind of shepherd me into the game. And so I ended up going to the local library to see if they had any of the books, and they had this old beat up copy of the first edition Dungeon Master's Guide. So I checked that out, and you know, anybody who has read the old first edition Dungeon Master's Guide probably knows it as the most arcane of any edition, any rule set. And so here I was. This is my first introduction to the game, was reading through that book. And unfortunately, the library did not have copies of the Player's Handbook or the Monster Manual. And so I was trying to learn how this game worked without a copy of the Player's Handbook, just by reading the Dungeon Master's Guide and inferring everything that they were referencing, but not actually stating out loud, because there was this other book that I'm not even sure I realized I was missing.
So you're getting like secondhand information. You don't actually have the rule set in front of you.
Right. Yeah.
Wow.
And so I kind of, you know, reverse engineered the game from what I could piece together from the dungeon, from the DMG. And yeah, they had like a stripped down list of monster stats in one of the appendices. And so I took that and just kind of created what I thought a character sheet was supposed to look like, and grabbed one of my friends, and we started playing.
Wow.
Talk about creativity right there. When I first started out, I started with Redbox Edition and very quickly went to Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, as they called it. It was basically second ed. Mm-hmm. And I, once again, rural Georgia, you know, not a lot of D&D players out there. So it was me and one friend who played. That was it for like several years. I didn't really start playing with large groups until mid-90s when I moved to a bigger city.
Hmm.
But yeah, it's...
Go ahead. So you started writing for Dungeon and for, I guess, WotC in general?
Mm-hmm.
In fourth edition, then. How did you get to that point?
So at that point, it was right after I had moved to San Francisco. It was shortly after my wife and I got married. We moved to San Francisco, and I was looking for a gaming group, got one together. We started meeting up every week, and I was running when the group started. It was shortly before fourth edition came out, so we were running a 3.5 game. And then fourth edition came out, and so I started running that. And that was the first time that I'd ever had like a really regular D&D game with a stable group of people. I mean, I had had a group some years before that I'd done some second edition with, but it was really having those weekly games where I was able to actually start taking this group through multiple adventures and actually start playing through campaigns like what everybody imagines that you're supposed to do, the way that the game's presented.
Question for you. When you started out running, were you using modules or were you homebrewing stuff?
So I started off with modules. For when we first kicked off with 3.5, I ran the old Forge of Fury module because it was one of the only two that I had on my bookshelf. And then fourth edition, I ran the Keep on the Shadowfell, right, which was the first published module for that edition.
Wickles knows all of them. All the fourth edition ones, he pretty much ran them.
Yeah, that was a good one. I wanted to run that one just to see what a fourth edition adventure looked like, right? But then after that, I took it into a homebrew game and ended up, doing a whole campaign. And I pulled a couple of the other official modules in. Like I remember I pulled in the King of the Trollhunt Warrens.
Mm.
I kind of took inspiration from that story arc that they were doing through the whole adventure series, with it culminating in Orcus as being the big baddie at the end of the campaign.
So I have to ask you, you may or may not remember, because it was a decade ago. So Keep on the Shadowfell, when you finally get through the keep and you go through the whole dungeon and you fight the Orcus, I think it was a war priest or something like that at the end, and you beat him, and there's that portal that he was trying to open down there. Did your players by chance walk through that?
No, but okay. From what I'm hearing about your group, it doesn't surprise me at all. Yours
did. So yeah, I explained the portal. I explained, like, you know, Orcus's hand coming out and, you know, doing stuff. And they're like, "This is a good idea." And they like almost lock hands and just like skip into the portal. I'm like, "You're all instantly dead. Reroll new characters." Just.
Oh man.
And they were upset too. Like, what do you mean it instantly kills us? Like, you're dead. You're brought to a situation that you cannot be. Your life force is drained from you to walk through this portal. And they're like, man, it sucks. Like, but at least you stopped the big bad, I guess. That's what really matters.
Yeah.
And what's weird too is I actually pulled in a bunch of that the troll stuff as well too in mine, because once I finished with Keep of the Shadowfell, I kind of went off script, just almost like you did too. Mm-hmm. And I remember about that point in time, there was an expansion book with monsters, and I tried to focus them on the black dragon that was in the swamp south of Fallcrest, and try to use some of the Warforged corpse collecting monsters that they had in there, and I liked those a lot. So that's kind of how I turned my group before the 4E collapse happened. That's what I'll call it.
Yeah. So, but at any rate, so, you know, it was running that campaign, you know, running for that group, you know, week after week. And I was also, you know, had a subscription to the Dungeon and Dragon magazines, and was mining those for ideas and content as well. When I, you know, finally got the idea of pitching some stuff to them, you know, and I only mention my own campaign because it was really, it is really running games, you know, in my mind at least. That's kind of the forge where, you know, design ideas come from, right? Yeah, I mean, it's even as now an experienced designer, you know, it's like, you know, I can sit here all week and work on adventures to publish, or work on, you know, other kind of content, you know, and systems and whatnot. But at the end of the day, it always comes back to actually running a game. And having that kind of living experience going, that really provides the inspiration to be like, okay, what, you know, now what do I want to make for this game? You know, what more can I add and provide for other people to have experiences, right? But otherwise it feels too theoretical. To be writing for something that you're not actively playing. And so it was really kind of, you know, being born out of having of doing all that play week after week, you know, that all of a sudden all these ideas started bubbling up, you know, and I started thinking, hey, you know, maybe I can publish some of this stuff. So yeah, the first thing that I ended up, well, no, it wasn't the first thing I pitched. I sent the magazines several pitches, and got a couple of rejections back. But I finally pitched them one idea, and the first one that they bid on was for this custom injury system that I had developed and I was using with my home game, where, you know, in fourth edition, it was, you know, kind of the first edition where they had, you know, really tried to get away from the idea of the cleric being the necessary group healer, you know, and, you know, so provided the ability for all characters to heal themselves through the use of their healing surges.
Yeah, earlier editions, you did not survive if you didn't have a cleric with you.
Right.
It was a necessity.
And so, you know, which I thought was a cool idea, but then, you know, what ended up happening in the game, you know, as we would play is just, you know, everybody would be fighting and, you know, I'm noticing, you know, two things. Number one, that it's, you know, it's dreadfully hard to actually kill the party off because they've got so many resources. You know, and number two, that, you know, as we were doing these combats, people would keep dropping, you know, during the combat and then, you know, healing themselves or healing each other and whatnot. And there was almost this sense that it's like, you know, it was better, you know, rather than quote unquote wasting your action to heal somebody while they've still got hit points remaining, you know, it was better to let them to just drop, you know, because there were no negative hit points. They would just drop to zero and then you could heal them from zero. Yeah, and they'd receive the full benefit of that healing and then stand back up and keep fighting. You know, I was trying to think of some way to, you know, to make getting dropped on the battlefield sting a little bit more, you know, to not to you know, penalize players necessarily, but just to make them feel like, oh, you know, maybe it would be a good idea if we didn't just let our characters get cut down left and right. And so that was where that idea came from. And then at the time, you know, in my game at home, I had actually done it up as like a little deck of cards where I had written up all these different injuries and made them into a deck of cards that my players would draw from every time they got injured. And, you know, so when I originally pitched the idea, I thought, oh, I'll have to put this into a rollable table or something because,
yeah, you know, D&D likes rolls.
Right, yeah. But then I noticed that that some of the other products that WotC was launching at that time were starting to include decks of cards. And I thought, oh, well, maybe, you know, maybe they would be open to the idea of a printable card deck for this. So I pitched it to them and sure enough, they were interested. And so that was the Less Death, More Danger was my first publication there with the printable injury deck. And then after that, I pitched them some adventure ideas and that was how I got started writing for Dungeon Magazine.
Yeah, Chris, I know, he had his own injury table, I think, for 4th edition also, was it?
Mm-hmm. It was actually for 5th.
Okay.
I modified the Fantasy Flight Star Wars critical injury table. So, like, if there was a critical hit on a player, they would suffer an injury of some kind. But, like, you know, disadvantage on your next attack or something along those lines. Just to kind of give a little more flair to, you know, the combat. It was funny you mentioned that you got kind of annoyed at the people dropping and just coming right back up. As I mentioned earlier, Jay and I play a LARP together, and and the whole concept of that game is we call it the one body game, where you just kind of wait for the fighters to drop and you hit them with your lowest healing spell to bring them back up, and they just keep on trucking. And that's my job. I'm the fighter. Jay is actually the healer. Yeah, he'll hit me with like 4 hit points. And I just keep swinging like nothing happens, and I drop.
He'll stand up, swing 3 or 4 times, go back down. I heal him again. Stands up, swings 3 or 4 times. Repeat.
Yeah. So that the one body game is just something we just have accepted as like just always happens.
Yeah, I'm having trouble even getting to that in my Rime of the Frostmaiden campaign right now. One of my players
be aware we try to avoid Frostmaiden spoilers as much as possible, so just
okay. Yeah nothing to do with the story, but yeah, one of my players rolled up a Twilight cleric from Tasha's, you know, where he can use a channel divinity to do an aura that gives the entire party temp hit points every round for the entire encounter. it's just monstrous.
Oh, yeah. So I'm playing in another campaign. It's not Frost Maiden, but yeah, we have two clerics with us. And one of them, like, he'll just burn his fifth level slot for aid every morning. So we're all running around with like 20 or 30 extra hit points.
My group doesn't have any healers, so.
It's funny because this is the first campaign with this group of players that we've ever had a cleric. Like, when normally we don't have clerics, we might have a bard or something with healing word, and we just let people drop, and, you know, here's you a healing word, get back up, keep going.
My group goes with the mentality of, we just hit it first and the hardest, and we will win, right? Question mark.
And how many have died so far?
Three.
Oh, that's pretty low.
Yeah, yeah. The only thing I modified that was custom for Icewind Dale was I made this,
the whole campaign.
The whole, yeah, at this point in time, the whole campaign, and I talked to you about that. But I made cold weather clothing that had durability on it, so when they took like 5 points of damage, that would, you know, knock off like a level of durability on the cold weather clothing. Because I wanted the weather and the effects to actually matter. And like, you just throw on cold weather clothing and everything is perfectly fine as long as you don't get wet. And right. I'm like, well, we're not tracking things getting wet, so we'll just, you know, track things, the durability of the clothing, and you just have it, like, you know, deteriorate over time, you know, from combat or a bad, you know, wilderness encounter of some kind. And it never panned out, you know, just they kept to the roads and kept moving and stuff like that. And, you know, it kind of fell by the wayside. I tend to find that a lot of the cool tables that I make that are extra additions to kind of like fill in a gap or make things a little more thematic, that I usually tend to forget to implement them as much as I want to, and they just, the ideas fall aside for just more core mechanics than anything else.
Yeah, like our earlier editions were very, you know, here's alternate rules, here's your tables for this stuff. And as the game has progressed, as D&D's changed over the years, it's gotten a lot more streamlined. So you have less tables and less alternate rules. But yeah, it works out fine because it's a role-playing game, so you can modify or add whatever you want here and there. It's just you get a lot less official stuff of that nature.
Yeah, and I, you know, Chris, my experience has been, you know, the same as yours, where I also tried to come up with some stuff at the beginning of my campaign to, you know, to try to impress a little bit more the survival challenges of the setting. And like yours, is almost redundant at this point. It's just the characters have so many resources that any challenges I try to throw at them that way often end up being trivial, even with my modifications. And then B, it's just there's more important and interesting stuff to do. There's a whole world of adventure from the go do, and even I can't be bothered with tracking all the travel and survival stuff. So it's okay, on to the next.
Yep. Yeah, my guys just go from one location to the next in like clockwork. You know, initially when I started the Icewind Dale campaign, it was, okay, well, I'm going to track your weight, I'm going to track the supplies, and so forth. And the farther we get into it, you know, they just, now at this point, they've all got dog sleds, they've got, you know, axe beaks, they can just carry whatever they need to. So the whole tracking, it's kind of pointless for the most point.
Yeah, one thing that's actually beneficial for on my end is I use D&D Beyond for all the character sheets, and I always thought that players could carry too much stuff. So being able to toggle on the variant encumbrance rule and having it just automatically be there and affect the character sheet without the players really have to interacting much with it helps out quite a lot. you know, something that's hands off for me. I don't have to monitor it. The players do, and it's automatically already factored into that sheet, which is really kind of cool.
Yeah, we're using that as well, and I agree. That's the one thing that it has been. It has enough of an effect that that it changes their behavior a little bit. But it's not. It's not sucking away time at the table. So.
Yeah, and it's helped out too because like I always like playing the dwarf that carries everything a lot of the times, and you know I'm always playing strength characters, so I can always still kind of carry everything even with variant encumbrance.
You are not Wick.
But it had the effect because like in the current dungeon they're going through, they got into a room that had a lot of treasure and they were like, all right, we'll come back for this later. You know, and that's the effect that I wanted versus my experience in fourth edition, which was like, oh, it's a entire hoard of silver coins from a, you know, white dragon. Okay, we'll just carry it all with us. Yeah, it's 7.5 tons, but coin weight doesn't matter.
So. Right.
We'll just put it all in a single bag of holding.
So when you actually get a chance to work on like Legacy of the Crystal Shard and the Princes of the Apocalypse, like how is it working with WotC as a huge project like that? How was that experience? Like, what did they actually ask you to do, I guess?
Yeah. So, usually they're coming to me with a design pitch, right? It's kind of the other way around, you know, from working with the magazines where, you know, I was pitching them ideas. With a big project like that, you know, they'll come to me with their ideas and say, okay, here's kind of our concept. Does this sound like something you're interested in? You know, and if yes, then okay. Then they come back with their outline, for the project. And sometimes they'll have a very specific piece that they want me to work on, and you know, sometimes they'll be a little more open in terms of, okay, you know, which part or what parts of this do you want to take on? Then once I've got kind of my piece of the puzzle, it's pretty independent. It's not, I'm not, online constantly with the other writers or editors throwing ideas back and forth necessarily. It's very much just kind of, I dig into my piece of it. And then, if and when questions arise, if I need to understand how something plugs into the larger whole, then obviously I'm going back to them and asking questions. But, I think also, certainly more so as they've gone on with their kind of design frameworks for fifth edition, a lot of the content is a little more modular, even though they're putting out these, huge 300-page adventure books or what have you. If you look into them, you realize that, these adventures are actually collections of mini adventures or, little encounter locations that are all strung together. That's by design. Obviously they want people to be able to, pick up an adventure and engage with it in a single setting, sitting. Right. So even though, yes, you've got this huge campaign that's a year or more's worth of material that you can play through if you want, you can also just pick it up and say, okay, tonight we're just going to run a little one shot, and it's going to be, the cave outside of East Haven or, whatever. And that could be it. You could run that in one session and there's your game for the night, and it doesn't have to doesn't have to tie into the larger campaign. And so that makes it, you know, a little easier to work on as well as a freelancer, you know, and for them to manage, you know, with multiple authors and whatnot, where not every piece has to be, you know, intricately involved with every other design piece. You know, each author can kind of work on their sections, and then of course they bring it in and start, you know, hammering out any, you know, inconsistencies or tying things together more. Yeah. You know, and you know, and they will make notes also in their outlines about, you know, here's how we want you to, or here are some opportunities to tie it into other threads that are going on in the adventure.
Got it. Yeah, like one thing, it's sort of just from listening to what you're saying, and honestly, having watched Chris run his version of Icewind Dale, which is not even really the written version of Icewind Dale, if I was to run it a second time, I would run it completely different from how I'm doing it. So this is, Icewind Dale is actually the first module I have ever run in my 30 years of D&D. And I've been DMing that entire time. So I'm just running it by the book because that's how I see it. And now I'm listening to you see how he's doing it. And honestly, I would go way off script if I ran it a second time. because it is, like you've said, you know, Icewind Dale, very specifically, I'm sure a lot of the other modules are this way, it is broken down into a whole lot of mini adventures. And, you know, you can alter those, you can throw them out and create your own to fill the void. It really is a campaign that could be homebrewed from nearly beginning to end.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, like I really like that, and I'd never thought of it that way until just a couple of days ago.
So what parts of let's take Prince of the Apocalypse did you write?
So that one specifically, I designed the Black Geode, which was the dungeon kind of at the end of the Earth Cult story arc, where you know, you go through these caves that have been heavily warped by the powers of elemental earth, and at the end of that you're either facing down with the prophet of earth or you're facing down with Ogrimmok, who is the elemental prince of earth.
Okay, so you just had that one, so basically they presented you like, hey, these are the things we want people to write, and you pick this one, or you were asked to write for that part, and you kind of wrote, you did the whole dungeon, kind of, I guess, probably sketched out what the dungeon looked like too and all that.
Did the dungeon map. I mean, yeah, sketched it out. Obviously, they have an artist who does the final art, but I was not presented with a location, so that whole dungeon was my design and mapping and whatnot.
Awesome.
Yeah, and you know, that was, I think that was actually maybe the first time that I got into what has become kind of my standard, my go-to way of mapping out and creating dungeons, which, you know, not that this is unique by any stretch, but I found it very helpful, which was to design it as a flowchart rather than trying to sit down and go straight into a map. Right, and so thinking about, you know, just the form that I want the dungeon to take, and not even the specific locations, but just, you know, how do I want this dungeon to flow? You know, how large should it be? You know, how many different areas do I want? How do I want them to connect up? You know, kind of what do I want the journey through this space to look like? And then once I've got that kind of mapped out, then taking a second pass at it and still, you know, still just with the flowchart, then going back and saying, okay, now what are these spaces? Right. And maybe I've made some notes jotted some notes down as I've been sketching out the flowchart. If I have a particular idea, right, you know, usually there will be a couple of spaces that I already have in my mind. Like, you know, I remember with the black geode, you know, I had the idea for the entranceway just being this, you know, underground causeway with these giant statues of the earth cultists flanking it and, you know, looking down over the heroes as they entered. And I had, you know, an idea of a ravine that ended up kind of being a central node in the dungeon. But then, you know, going back and just thinking, okay, what are each of these places going to be? What's, and really trying to, really trying to give each area a unique character, right? Or a unique hook, you know, what's interesting about this location? What's different about that? And, you know, and that really was essential to me with that one, because caves can be such a challenge. You know, if you're mapping a dungeon or a castle or something, you know, there's lots, those are living spaces or working spaces. So there's lots of, you know, room to easily glom onto different areas as, oh, you know, this is the armory and this is the library and this is the barracks, right? But it's like a cave is just, it's, you know, one damn room after another.
You know, just, yep.
Just a bunch of rocks, right?
Yeah, and a lot of them might just be empty space. I mean,
right, yeah. And so, you know, and so really trying to give each chamber, you know, its own unique flavor, you know, and then, you know, only then once I have the entire structure mapped out and the, and I have the unique, you know, hooks for each room and I know what they all are, you know, and then it's pulling out the graph paper and seeing, okay, what does this actually look like, right?
And that's very interesting. You brought up that method, because I've always, you know, whenever I've created dungeons or created like encounters, whatnot, I always start with like, all right, let's map this thing out 100% first and then start writing the encounters to fill in the spaces. Mm-hmm. And I think it was only when I started to actually went through Ashley Warren's RPG Writer Workshop that, you know, they brought up the idea of doing the flowchart first. And it's weird to me that I didn't think of that, because I come from a technical writer background, and the first thing I have to do is come up with the outline first and make a flowchart of it. So I don't know why I never made that connection when it comes to creating dungeons or even creating, you know, a homebrew world.
Yes.
It's something I've started doing now, but it's just weird that I never thought of it that way.
Yeah, and I come from a cartography background, so the first thing I'm going to do is sketch out a map.
Mm-hmm. And it's weird, because I was actually taking a look at the black geode and the map and everything, and looking at the rooms, and one thing I noticed too is that I think it was one of the other books had a cave. It was one of the, I think the book with T went on it, Tyranny of Dragons.
There's a
cave in there too, and it is a cave, but essentially it's just a den. So like, here's the armory room, here's this room, here's that room, and mm-hmm. it's just like, well, this could just be a dungeon. It could just be a building. You know, it is a building just in cave form. You know,
right.
Whereas looking at yours, it's like this is an actual cave full of things. Like they don't. They may have like an arcane foundry or something, but they don't have like, here's the barracks of the cave, you know, mm-hmm. kind of thing going on. So that's something to keep in mind when players are creating something. It's like, don't just take your traditional dungeon and just fill it in a cave environment and move on. And that's good advice for me, because I have plans for another one shot, and I was going to make a dungeon. I was already thinking about it last night, and I was like, okay, well, this could be the room that's going to have all of the provisions and stuff. And now that you say this, and then I see that, I'm like, I can't do that. You know, I can't just take this building and put it here in this different environment and call it done. I gotta think of things like what would really be here in this structure or this in this cave environment that would actually really be here. So that's very interesting.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, and also, you know, obviously, anytime you've got residents in the dungeon, you know, yes, they're going to need sleeping, a place to sleep. Yes, they're going to need provisions. But at the same time, you know, if a room's entire identity is this is the room with the provisions, that's not terribly exciting.
Yeah, it's kind of boring. It's just a room. It's a room to dig through a couple of crates and then get out of.
Yeah. And so it's you know, again, you know, kind of coming from the first principles of what is this dungeon, it's like, okay, well, you know, what was this place? This yes, it's the place where the current residents have put their provisions, but what was it before that? All right, what was going on here before they ever showed up?
Right.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, was maybe easier for me to...
Hey, you back?
Yeah. Sorry, I'm not sure what happened there.
Oh, it's okay.
I was swallowed by the elemental maw. Giving away too many of its secrets.
No! What were you just saying? Forgot.
Well, I'm not sure where I cut it out there, but
yeah.
I was just talking about how you could have some dungeons, you know, and caves and whatnot that would be heavily defined by their residents, you know, if they've been purposefully created as living spaces, mm-hmm. whereas someplace like the Black Geode was first and foremost a fane of elemental power, you know, so it was really about Earth in its rawest form, you know, so even though you do have humanoids, you know, these cultists that have that are occupying the caves, you know, they aren't really its masters. Mm-hmm. And this place is not for them. Right, so it's
they're squatters.
Yeah, exactly.
So when you wrote the Black Geode and you sent it back to Wizards, did they change a lot of it, or what was that process like?
Yeah, so actually that one was a little different. At that time, the development on that was being done by Sasquatch Studios. Right when 5th edition came out, WotC was really focused on getting the core rule books out. And so they actually contracted some other studios to do their first adventures. So I know it was one other studio did the Tyranny of Knee of Dragons. I forget if that was Kobold Press or maybe it was somebody else. I can't remember. And then Sasquatch Studios got the contract to work on Princes of the Apocalypse. And so I was actually working with Rich Baker, who is at Sasquatch, who brought me on to that project. You know, and then later they turned the manuscripts over to WotC, who did the final pass on that before publication. So it, you know, it changed a little bit. The map, you know, and the layout and general features of the dungeon as I created them stayed the same. You know, some of the room descriptions, I think some of the read aloud text got revised. If memory serves, I think my room descriptions were perhaps a bit florid and had to be tightened up. I was waxing poetical about earth and mud and stone.
Hey, personally, I like that. I do it myself. So.
Yeah, certainly that's something I've come to have a greater appreciation for. The more that I work on game design is trying to find that economy of words. When it comes to the read aloud text, and Maybe one or two of the encounters changed a little bit. I think they toned down the Ogrimmok encounter from my initial concept. Maybe toned down isn't the right word. I think I had scripted it a little bit more heavily, okay. You know, and I think they just kind of opened that up a little bit more. But mostly, you know, certainly recognizable in its final form.
For the most part, they ran with what you gave them. So
yeah.
You had mentioned earlier you were back at it. Is there any way you could tell us what you're working on at the moment, or is that hush hush?
Yeah, unfortunately, I can't. Can't speak to it because nothing
officially
announced yet. But I'll certainly out once things are out in the open. So
yeah, let us know. We'll pitch it for you as well. So.
Yeah, absolutely. But exciting stuff in the works. So.
But you did publish your own, like, coming back to it thing on DM's Guild. What was it like writing back for that after all those years away for a little bit?
Yeah. So when I first came back, you know, I was still reaching out to my contacts to see about getting on some larger projects. Obviously I knew that. That people were publishing on the DM's Guild, and that was something I wanted to check out. I went and joined the community there for anybody who is, who are creators or aspiring creators, looking at getting in on that. There's a fabulous community over there. Get involved with them on Facebook and Twitter and Discord, just a fabulous group of creators. That, of course, is where I met you, Chris.
Yep.
And so went there and decided to try my hand at self-publishing, and that's really interesting. It was a very different experience, because, coming from a world where I was, working with publishers and, either pitching concepts or being pitched concepts, and, just kind of my only job was, writing and design, take this concept, bang out a manuscript and hand it in and call it a day, to this world of self-publishing where it's like, okay, well, before I even do that, I first have to think, what can I even put on here that anybody is going to be interested in, right? Because it's doing the market research, right? And then, of course, doing the design, and then you've got to do layout, and then you've got to source art, and then you have to publish, and then you have to do marketing, all these things that I've never done before. So,
hey, yeah. Chris, he literally described everything you've been doing the past year.
The marketing is the hard part, man. I still don't have a huge grasp on that, but. I haven't done anything from definitely professional, I guess, from actually like working with a publishing company or anything like that. But it was almost otherworldly trying to get my publications out there. Like I had the idea, I had the modules, I had the fights, and here I can take going from like my notes of how things should go and then actually putting them in like a template and a layout and make it readable and flow correctly. Just the amount of extra work that had to go into that was, I definitely underestimated how much extra work goes into actually making something presentable. And it's really weird that I had that kind of weird epiphany because I come from a technical writing background. I've written user manuals and, you know, software development sheets and STDs, SVDs, all these technical documents. And at the end of the day, a, you know, campaign guide is just a technical manual to me.
Right.
Yeah. And it's just like, it was very interesting seeing how much extra work it took to actually get it to that point. And I went through yours. I think it's called
Willow's Wrath. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's very interesting. And I think I bought everyone's, I was part of the RPG Writer Workshop in the summer and fall of last year. And I bought everyone's publication from the summer course. Everyone that I could find. It's something like 100 different people with publications. And just seeing how different it was from each person, how some people had the idea of formatting and how to get all the stuff in there. You really need to have a huge skill set to be able to publish your own thing. And I can see why people reach out and have other people do layouts or do editing and whatnot. I'm very lucky in that my wife is a very good editor. Mm-hmm. So I can type everything up. And I code her, it's like, hey, sweetie, I got the first draft done. And yes, I read through it. And I promise you, I've caught most of the errors. And then that's a total lie. And then I give it to her.
Right.
And then he sends it to me. And then I'm like, nope, that's wrong.
And yeah. So I had to lean on my friends and family considerably in order to get the first publication done. But when it was done and out there, it was a weird euphoria kind of thing. Like, here's something that you've actually put out there in the world that people can see. And just to kind of see how many people from that summer course have now moved on to other things and are doing more modules and, you know, collaborating with other people and just kind of almost making or trying to make a career out of it as well. It's very, very interesting how many opportunities there are with the DMs Guild. And I had always looked at it kind of like, well, if I publish on there, no one's ever going to notice it. No one's ever going to notice, you know, I'm just going to be drowned out by the huge number of submissions that happen on a DMs Guild on a daily basis. And that really wasn't the case. Just everyone in the RPG Writer Workshop has had some good success when it comes to their publication. And now you have a publication. Like, you have this now. It's like, it's a great thing. And so I can't thank DMs Guild enough for just being there as a resource, you know?
Yeah. It's an awesome location and really has enabled this community. One of my realizations as I started working on it and got more involved with that creator community is, just how many opportunities there are to get involved. Because, you know, again, I'm coming in from a writing and design standpoint, but then coming into it, obviously, you've got artists, you've got editors, you've got people doing layout. It's like, yeah, that hadn't even occurred to me that, oh yes, there are people who all they do is lay out other people's adventures, right? And it's spectacular. You know, I look at especially some of the stuff going up on DriveThruRPG and some of these independent games going up, and now. Again, you know, it's one of those things where it's almost invisible to you until you've grappled with it. And so having gone through that process and having had to try to do my own layout, now I look at pieces and I think, wow, what great layout. it's phenomenal, you know, and then project managers, right? You've got, because, you know, again, there's so much, this is something that, again, you know, maybe is not evident until you kind of get into it and you see what's going on from the inside. So much of what's going on the DMs Guild nowadays are not just, individual creators, putting up individual works, but it's whole teams, right? It's that's mm-hmm. You know, it feels like a professional industry where you've got people pitching projects and hiring on writers and artists and editors and whatnot, and so you've got people who all they do all day long is manage these projects. And so it's like, even if you've never written an adventure in your life and you're never going to write an adventure in your life, you can still get involved if you're good
at herding cats and coordinating between people, you've got a job.
Yeah. You know, if you've got a product idea that you would love to see somebody else write, go find somebody to write and then, help move that over the finish line. Right. Cause there's room for everybody in there. It's just awesome.
So like one of the things that recently came out was Eyes Unclouded, which was like a huge campaign setting kind of taken from Studio Ghibli. Mm-hmm. And I've been trying to get my wife to go through and read it. So I let her have a chance at DMing and seeing that side of the table. And that's why I keep pitching there. But that team was like 45 people that wrote that.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
It was huge. And, it's already mithril status on DM's Guild, which is, big goals. But, now they have a hardcover book that they're printing out. So, at some point in time, DM's Guild is for the, everyman. But at the same time, too, it's like you can put out this huge adventure, at a high professional standard, It's mm-hmm. really, really quite amazing.
Yeah. And then, of course, like with you, I find the marketing to be, one of the hardest parts to wrap my head around.
Yeah.
But again, part of the benefit of getting in on a group project like that is, now you're marketing it not just to your network, you're marketing it to the network of every person who contributed to that project, right?
So, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely going to see more success that way.
Yeah, like I've been so far, my marketing tactic is just spam Twitter and Facebook until everybody hates me or buys it and tells me to stop. So, but to be fair, my first publication is approaching gold medal at the moment, which is
that's awesome.
I think I'm like a 350 or around that mark.
That's less than a year since you put it out.
But I owe it all to the artist, the cover artist that, a friend of mine, I commissioned her to do the drawing and to draw that Icewind Devil, the mm-hmm. Ice Devil in the ice cube. And like the adventure could be, total crap. I think people just bought it just for that picture alone. So
it's a great cover.
Yeah. If it has great artwork, people will notice it. They'll at least then look more into it. If it's just a rehashed, reused piece of art, not going to get as many views on it.
I like that cover art so much. I actually printed it out on a piece of canvas, and it's hanging in my room.
I have been thinking about doing that with some of mine because I love all that artwork.
I'm very lucky in that I have a lot of through the LARP specifically. I have a lot of contacts, a lot of people who are very good artists. And
yeah, the second one was Adam Schumpert, wasn't it?
Yeah, Adam Schumpert.
He's actually done like artwork for Fantasy Flight and a lot of other big companies.
Yeah, nice. Have you ever seen the game Android Netrunner? All the RPG books in the box set is his artwork. So I have access to the art side of things, and that's taken care of. I just have to come up with the financial backing to pay for them. So between the stock art that I can use on DM's Guild and them creating individual pieces, I think I'm good with art. All I have to handle is the writing.
Yeah.
I actually went through with the Christmas one shot and actually hired somebody else. I actually wanted to experience the process of hiring somebody and like pitching them the idea of like, hey, this is what I want, and then coming back with what they have and sending back notes to clean up stuff. So like I commissioned mm-hmm. someone to draw Krampus for my Christmas module, And that was a very interesting experience. It was really nice working with that guy on that, and, you know, getting a unique piece of art just that is just Krampus, and which was very interesting. So I'm trying to use DM's Guild and use all the connections that I've made through RPG Writer Workshop to kind of experience that idea and actually hire people. And I'm actually thinking of hiring a layout artist next time. Even though I can do the layout, I want to see like what their process is so I can get a better understanding and hopefully make my layouts better in the future. So that's, you know, I know that I like making a lot of projects, and, you know, the dream is to, you know, get something officially published, you know, but in a sense it really already has, because it's on DM's Guild and it is officially published.
Yeah. And I'll say even having, you know, worked on official publications, yeah, it was still a thrill for me.
You mentioned at the very beginning that you, you cut out there for a second. I apologize.
Yeah. That's all right. What are you saying?
I said, you mentioned at the very beginning of when we started talking that you worked for with Scott Kurtz, Toonhound Studios.
Yeah.
And you did the Table Titans. I bought that. I never got a chance to read that or run that. I loved Table Titans. I bought everything I could before I got married for their stuff. What was it like working for a famous person and like their kind of creation? Was that any different than like working for WotC?
It was certainly different. It was a lot of fun. I enjoyed working with the guys over at Toonhound Studios. You know, Scott is just he effuses enthusiasm and excitement, you know, for the game, you know, in a way that you know, it's like the excitement that you know I felt when I was, you know, back getting into the game, you know, when I was 13 years old, right? You know, where just everything is new and exciting, and you know, now as a 40-something, having played this game for decades, right? It's easy sometimes to get a little cynical or to feel like this has already been done to death, you know.
That's literally last podcast episode. Everything's been done before.
Right. I almost had like a little, you know, crisis of faith, you know, a couple of years ago where I'm like, why am I even playing this game? I mean, I love it, right? But it was like, really, why, you know, why do I keep doing this week after? Like, it's not like I've never run a Goblin Stronghold before. Like, how many times do I want to do this? You know?
Yep.
you know, and you know, I kind of found my way through that, but yeah, we're working with Scott, yeah, he's just got that enthusiasm. It gives me that feeling of like, you know, everything old is new again. Right. And so, yeah. I love that and, love bringing that in. And so, you know, and of course he invents all these ideas for, you know, his stories in the comic strip, and for the setting that they're all, you know, taking place in and whatnot. And so just listening to him talk about it, you know, gets me excited. You know, and then I go in, you know, and start, yeah, thinking, okay, what kind of adventure can I create for people to experience this for themselves, right? And then it feeds back, right? You know, and then I you know, pass these adventures back to Scott, you know, and then he loves it, right? You know, because of course, you know, he plays D&D, but he's not a game designer. You know, he's not going to write his, you know, adventures for publication, you know, and so then, you know, he gets excited about what I'm doing, and then, you know, he throws me more ideas, you know, it's back and forth. So yeah, it's just
everybody.
It's a lot of fun that way.
Enthusiasm, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so yeah, that was a fun project, and you know, hopefully got more fun stuff on the way.
Yeah, like I said, I really liked his Benwin character. Like I said, because Acquisition Incorporated is how I got into D&D, was that group, mm-hmm. you know, and to seeing, you know, how it's changed. Like now Table Titans is a split off brand from that, you know, as well too. And it's just like, to just see how one idea and, you know, a wizard, a fighter, and a cleric walk into a dungeon is the most tried and true story that's ever existed. And, you know, you look at it now, and now it's like, you know, a corporate CEO that's like time traveling and interplane hopping in Forgotten Realms, while you have Benwin over here in his own universe doing his own thing, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting to see how far you can just take a simple concept that's been done 1,000 times before and come up with something that is totally different and totally unique. Because those characters grow over time. Like you wrote a companion book for Icewind Dale with a bunch of companions in there, and they're all just, you know, chock full of potential to be, you know, world changing if you just take them and run with them and see how the players go. And that's kind of like how I try to run my campaigns. Is I started with Icewind Dale in the book. Okay, mm-hmm. Great, cool. Here's your secret. Oh, you're going to take this secret and run it and spin it this way? Cool. Nothing bad will happen with that. 3 sessions later, so you're all allying yourself with the Frost Maiden, and you're just going to slaughter everybody now, I guess? Okay, let's just see how it goes.
You have officially become the bad guys.
Don't need this book anymore. So it's super interesting. We're actually just past the 1 hour mark. We've been talking for quite a while. We could probably keep talking for another hour. But before we end this, we have all our guests always add something to Craig and his never ending story.
So just imagine that you are creating a character. You know that it's uh-huh. going to be a full orc bard, and you've got a little bit of his backstory. He's got a older, smaller brother who goes by the name of Trevor, who bullies Craig. And Craig, let's see, what else was it? He plays the drums only, as far as being a bard. And, no, he plays wind instruments. I'm sorry. He only plays wind instruments. And he has a pixie by the name of Flicker that hangs around him all the time. So with this story, add anything that you would want to add to this character that you're creating. And if you want, it can just be a stat. You know, it can be a magic item. It can be whatever.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I think he probably has a bag of holding. Its name is Ordu.
Okay.
Because it used to be an ogre. It lost its head to some adventurers, but they took the head as a prize and enchanted it to swallow their belongings and then regurgitate them back out whenever it's needed.
That is fantastic. So Craig now has a bag of holding that is made from an ogre's head.
Ordu.
Named Ordu. Does it actually converse?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, Ordu, you know, gets hungry frequently and will ask Craig to, you know, feed me.
So he puts his flute or puts something down in there. And oh, that's great.
It comes back a little slimy sometimes.
Yeah. So it's not quite a bag of devouring, but kind of.
So yeah, you know, if you put something organic in there, it might go missing.
That's awesome.
I love it.
Well, Jeff, thank you very much for joining us. You know what we forgot? Now that I think about it,
what's that?
Your grumpiest story that you have as a DM.
My grumpiest story. Oh my goodness. So this would probably be the flack that my players gave me for one of the many party kills that they've endured. It was one of their most deserved, and they felt the most aggrieved by it, because it was the Crushing Walls trap.
I love traps.
And yeah, they walked into it. I can't even remember what the setup was. Yeah, they were in some tomb. I don't remember why they were there. You know, and the walls started coming out. It was like the trash compactor in Star Wars: A New Hope, right? The only sticky bit being instead of the garbage monster, there were a bunch of wraiths in the room, because it was a tomb, right? And so the wraiths could flit in and out between the walls, right? They didn't care about getting crushed. The party saw the walls are closing in, so a couple of them run out, and then some of them just stay and start fighting the wraiths. And as each round the walls are getting closer and closer, right? And we're playing on a grid, right? Because it was fourth edition. So we had the map out, and it's like each round I would move those walls one square closer so they can see very clearly what's happening and exactly how many rounds they have. And the guys in the room are not moving towards the exit. They're holding the fort, doing I don't know what they thought they were doing to fight against these wraiths. And then the characters who had already escaped and run out into the hallway turn around, realize that their companions are still fighting the race, and so run back into the room to back them up.
Oh no.
And then they all ended up getting crushed. And then afterwards they were so mad about it. I was like, I don't know what to tell you.
You had six obvious rounds to flee the area.
Yep. You had perfect control over that situation. I mean, might somebody have got, cut down by attacks of opportunity? Sure, right? I'm not saying that everybody could have fled and survived guaranteed, but absolutely, half the party was already out of there, and the others could have at least made a dash for it. And if one person falls, then
lose one, that's, save the other four.
Yeah,
that's
the way it goes sometimes. But nope, all for one and one for all. So that was the end of that campaign.
That's awesome.
Yep.
I love players too. This happened to me actually literally last night too, where I've been playing a Star Wars game with a friend of mine, and I'm playing a very evil Zeltron rogue, and we had found this Jedi holocron, the Sith holocron more specifically. And it's a master holocron, so it's huge, and it's got all this information on it. And being a Sith herself, I'm very attracted to this Sith holocron, and I keep getting closer to it because it's just radiating energy that I want to feed off of. And he says this door opens up, and I see, this green glowing, almost like scarab-like thing inside the Sith holocron. And I'm sitting there thinking, I'm like, okay, as a player, I know I touch that, I'm going to die. I just know it. I don't know what it is, but if I touch it, I'm going to die. And it's like, okay, does my character want to touch it? And she's not stupid. She's going to let her Jedi master look at it first and figure out what it is. So I kind of do a force sense on it, just to kind of get an idea of do I understand what it is? And he's like, no. And it's weird because it's not like the grander force. It's more like the living force that's in this thing. I was like, okay, cool. I'm going to let the Jedi master look at it first, and then we'll figure out what it is. And so when the Jedi master came over and looked at it, it was some kind of like scarab that feeds on Sith energy and is used as a torturing device. Like if you touched it, it would have just latched onto me and started draining all my force energy out of me. And so if I would have touched it, it would have been my fault, not the DM's fault. It's not the DM's fault the trap worked on the player.
Yeah.
It's the player's fault.
That's the best. Yeah. get them to to will it be willing participants in their own demise.
That's
I'm just gonna stay here and just stay in the crushing room. I'll be fine.
It's the worst that could happen. We saw how it ended in Star Wars. Nothing happened.
Yeah, right.
Well, Jeff, thank you again for joining us, and hopefully have you back on sometime.
Yep. Yeah, if there's anything you want to pitch, social media, etc.
Yeah, people can follow me on Twitter at The Open Tome. That's T-O-M-E, like the book. Or you can check out my website at theopentome.com. And thanks for having me on. It was a great time. Great chat.
Thanks for coming on.
All right, bye, guys.
Bye. See
ya. Hey, guys. Thanks for listening to our podcast. If you will, please check us out on our social medias on Facebook.
Grumpy Dungeon Masters.
Twitter.
At Grumpy DMs. _ DMs.
Instagram.
Grumpy Dungeon Masters.
And every Saturday night at what time?
8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
On?
Twitch.tv/Grumpy Dungeon Masters.
Fuck yeah.